Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in today for Marty Moskowain. The second impeachment trial of Donald John Trump is over. As the world was watching Saturday, all Democrats and some Republicans in the Senate found Trump guilty of incitement of insurrection related to the attack on the Capitol last month. But the 57-43 vote lacked the two-thirds majority necessary for conviction to become reality. So Trump was acquitted. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell did not vote to convict, but gave a blistering condemnation of Trump's actions, saying the former president was practically and morally responsible for the January 6th insurrection and that he displayed disgraceful dereliction of duty. McConnell also implied that a political fall from grace might happen for Trump at the hands of the judicial system. Meanwhile, Trump remains a potent force within the Republican Party, especially at the state and local levels, vowing that the MAGA movement has only just begun. So what happens next? There's a lot to unpack, and we'd like to hear what you think. Here's the number, 888-477-9499. Send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. Joining us this hour are Claire Finkelstein, professor of law and philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome, Claire.
Thanks for having me, Mary.
And Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, joins us once again. Hello, Julian.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So no surprises here with the acquittal. Julian, to you first.
No surprises. It was predictable that most Republicans would not vote to convict. It was a little higher in terms of the Republican vote than some people thought. But overall, partisanship, I think, triumphed over the balance of power and over any moral push to follow through with impeachment.
Claire, your thoughts?
It was not a surprise. What was a little bit of a surprise is what happened with the witnesses, because once there was a decision to call witnesses and the Senate had voted on it, that's when I thought maybe this could turn around. Had there been a large number of witnesses who might have been able to trace their way a little bit higher up the food chain and make explicit connections to Donald Trump on that day, and there were a number of senators who spoke with the president on that day, I thought this has the potential to turn things around. But a last-minute decision was made to pull the plug on witnesses and to accept a stipulation in lieu of the one witness who was called. And I think that once that was done, it was obvious that it was over.
All right. Let's get to the witnesses in just a bit in depth. First, I'd like to examine a big issue that was front and center during the trial, the definition of constitutionally protected speech. Let's listen to House lead manager Jamie Raskin here during his closing arguments on Saturday.
They attacked this building. They disrupted the peaceful transfer of power. They injured and killed people, convinced that they were acting on his instructions and with his approval and protection. And while that happened, he further incited them while failing to defend us. If that's not ground for conviction, if that's not a high crime and misdemeanor against the Republic and the United States of America, then nothing is. President Trump must be convicted for the safety and security of our democracy and our people.
And on Friday, former President Trump's defense team said his incendiary rhetoric leading up to the insurrection was protected under the First Amendment. Your take, Julian?
Well, there's two issues. One is, how does this look in a court of law? And the second is, how does it look in the court of Congress? And in the court of Congress, it doesn't seem so subtle. I mean, the president led a charge that lasted for over a month to attack and then overturn the election. And not only was the rhetoric of the president central in building the Stop the Steal movement, but he actually announced the rally many times. He encouraged people to come, culminating with not only his speech there before the rally begun, but also the continued tweets as this unfolded. So this seems to me a pretty clear case of a gross abuse of presidential power. And the connection with what happened in the insurrection is pretty direct.
Claire Finkelstein, your understanding of the parameters.
Yeah, with regard to the legal point that you asked, there's no legal protection on First Amendment grounds for inciting a mob to engage in violence. Both under the Brandenburg case that the Trump lawyers were frequently citing, there's, of course, a very important exception in that First Amendment line of cases, which is the proverbial shouting fire in a crowded theater. You're not allowed to endanger people around you in the exercise of First Amendment rights, and that's a very well-anchored provision and a principle under the First Amendment. And the other is the whole array of criminal charges that can be brought against someone who solicits or incites someone to commit a crime. Once you start looking at group criminality, conspiracy, solicitation, accomplice liability, the First Amendment just doesn't apply there. So your First Amendment rights do not cover criminal behavior, which always has to be done in words if there is more than one individual involved and one person is soliciting or encouraging another person to commit a crime. The First Amendment argument just did not work in this case.
So with this in mind, let's get to some comments from Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, who voted against the conviction but yet indicated that Trump could yet be held accountable for his actions.
President Trump is still liable for everything he did while he was in office as an ordinary citizen. Unless the statute of limitations is run, still liable for everything he did while he's in office. Didn't get away with anything yet. Yet. We have a criminal justice system in this country. We have civil litigation. And former presidents are not immune from being accountable by either one.
So, Claire, what might lie ahead for former President Trump?
Well, first of all, let me just make a comment on Mitch McConnell. I mean, his duplicity is extraordinary. When the House was debating 25th Amendment and whether or not to encourage Pence to invoke the 25th Amendment, he said, "Yeah, I might be in favor of impeachment." Then when the House had impeached, he said, well, we can't do this right now. Let's wait till he's no longer president. Once Trump was no longer president, he said, oh, whoops, you can't convict a sitting president on an impeachment trial. Now that he has won the battle to have Trump cleared, acquitted on the impeachment, he's saying, yeah, it could be criminal charges. Well, you can bet that he'll come out against criminal charges if he has any say at all in the matter. But I do think that former President Trump may face criminal charges. And in fact, there's several investigations going on right now with regard to his call to Secretary of State Raffensperger and also something with regard to Fulton County in Georgia. And then, of course, there's the Manhattan DA's investigations that are ongoing into financial matters. So I do think he's going to face criminal charges and that they may very well be warranted under these circumstances.
Julian Salazar, again, most if not all Republicans who voted to acquit said the trial was unconstitutional. An escape hatch for Republican senators afraid of retribution from the Trump base?
Well, it's a rhetorical escape hatch. I think most scholars agree that the impeachment was constitutional or the trial was constitutional. Everything was working within the parameters of the process set up to deal with an issue like this. That's separate than what do Republicans do about this situation, given it was so egregious. And I think that is a talking point. That's a way, and McConnell in some ways is invoking it, to say, yes, the president might have been guilty, but there's nothing we really can do about it because now he's no longer president. Even though, of course, as we just said, that's because McConnell didn't allow this to move forward before the term ended. But talking points are what senators look for. And I think that's the kind of justification you'll hear of as this continues to emerge.
Do you think Mitch McConnell will back off his anti-Trump rhetoric, especially as we move closer to the 2022 mid-cycle elections?
Of course he will. Senator McConnell operates by the principle of partisan power. And whatever is necessary to preserve that power is what guides him. And there's polls this morning in Politico showing that there's still incredibly strong support for the former president within the Republican Party. And there's not a lot of sentiment that the former president did anything wrong. And as those numbers continue, I think McConnell will back off. I don't think he has any interest in an open war, so to speak, with the former president. He's much more concerned about regaining control of the Senate.
Let's look at what's happening in our backyard here in the Delaware Valley. Republican Senator Toomey, Pat Toomey, voted to convict former President Trump and is now facing a huge backlash from county GOP organizations in Pennsylvania. And it seems likely the state, the GOP, could well vote to censure Toomey as well. This for a conservative senator who struggled with Trump's rhetoric at times, but voted with him most of the time. How do you interpret this censure, Julian, and what does this mean for Pennsylvania politics for the foreseeable future?
Well, I think Republicans in the state are coalescing around their party, around the former president, and indicating, as we're seeing in some other states, that the lack of tolerance is for those who went after President Trump rather than for former President Trump himself. And this is, you know, the pressure of partisanship is a bottom-up pressure often. And I think party activists and to some extent voters are going to make sure that there are no great defections. Everyone is talking about the possibility of a civil war in the Republican Party and will McConnell break. But I actually don't think we're even close to that. I think what you're going to see is anyone who is outspoken against the former president is censured or isolated within the party, if not just kicked out altogether.
Claire Finkelstein, describe censure and what it means to a politician's career.
Well, it really depends. Under these circumstances, this is an extraordinarily unprecedented set of circumstances where the country is so deeply divided. To some people, the possibility of censure will be worn as a badge of honor. But to these Republicans who have either very right-wing states or sort of purple states, as in the case of Pat Toomey here in Pennsylvania, we have a deeply divided state, and it may very well damage his political standing with some people. With other people, it'll be all the more reason to support him and to feel that he really acted courageously under the circumstances, given the pressure from the main bulk of the Republican Party, which has been extreme.
All right. We are talking about the acquittal of former President Trump in his second impeachment trial this hour. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty Moskowain has the day off. We are speaking with Claire Finkelstein, professor of law and philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania. Also, Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Join the conversation, 888-477-9499, or send an email to radiotimes@whyy.org. Stay tuned. You're listening.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
To WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Radio Times. Marty Moskowain has the day off today. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. We are looking at the second impeachment trial of former President Donald John Trump. Our guests this hour, Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, also the author of a new book, Burning Down the House, Newt Gingrich, The Fall of a Speaker and the Rise of the New Republican Party. Also, Claire Finkelstein, professor of law and philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania and director of Penn's Center for Ethics and the Rule of Law. Our lines are open, 888-477-9499. Send us an email to radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let's get to a comment from Margaret. She sent us an email, and she asks, if Trump is convicted of crimes in individual states, could he be disqualified from being on the ballot in those states in the future? Claire, do you have that information?
That is an excellent question, and the answer is emphatically yes, depending on what he would be convicted of, if convicted. If, for example, he were convicted of rebellion or insurrection, both of which are federal crimes, then under the 14th Amendment, he would be disqualified from running again. So that is an alternate route to impeachment and disqualification from office that would bring about the same effect. If he were instead convicted of election interference, that would not have the effect of disqualifying him from running for office.
Describe the 14th Amendment, because there has been some discussion about using this to prevent Trump from holding office again. What does it say?
Well, the 14th Amendment has a provision that says that anyone convicted of basically rebellion against the United States cannot hold public office thereafter. And so that directly speaks to this issue. The framers were very concerned. And of course, this was post-Civil War. But the framers were very concerned about having, insurrection be a basis for upsetting the republic. And that really came about, of course, during the Civil War. And then we have this post-Civil War provision that explicitly says if you rebelled against the United States, you cannot hold public office. And that was a direct response to what happened during the Civil War.
Julian, is there a concern that if such an effort were to fail, former President Trump then gets another victory in what he calls the witch hunt? And wouldn't this not only negate the effort to see that he doesn't hold office again, but damage efforts to keep him from winning should he run again?
Well, I mean, in terms of how the former president responds to these things, that's always a fear. That was the fear with impeachment. You move forward with impeachment, the Senate does what they just did. They don't vote to convict, and the president is emboldened. Other than barring him from holding federal office, I think his response will be the same. He'll always say it's a witch hunt. He'll always say that his opponents are out just to get him and that he does nothing wrong. So I don't think the courts, I don't think Congress, I don't think it's the right thing for them to be motivated by that fear. Ultimately, all they can do is put on the record what happened and what was wrong about what happened. And I think the assumption they have to make is what happened in 2020. Despite the first impeachment, despite the investigations, in fact, President Trump didn't win re-election. And a lot of the public, I'm sure, that was part of the calculation for voters. This is someone who can't hold power. So I think, you know, the different players just have to move forward based on their view of any abuses of power or crimes.
So, you know, he lost the presidency. He lost the Senate. The insurrection videos are not going anywhere. They'll be aired and re-aired again if he were to run for office. Is it best to leave this to the voters? Julian?
Well, I think I do think there are a lot of questions unanswered, and those answers also should be part of what voters know, meaning the decision not to move forward with witnesses and the decision to have a shorter trial meant there's a lot of gaps in our knowledge about just how extensive was the contact between the Trump administration and some of these groups, how much coordination was there, what happened on the day of the insurrection. And so I think if you put all that information out there with the commission, you're still letting voters make the decision, but they should have full knowledge of what we're talking about. A, should Trump run again? And B, just in terms of the Republican Party generally, we should know what ultimately did they decide to defend. So I don't think the two are contradictory.
Claire Finkelstein, what are your thoughts here?
There absolutely has to be a commission. Nancy Pelosi is 100% right, and I absolutely agree with Julian that the decision not to have witnesses resulted in a lot of gaps in our knowledge. We saw during the brief trial that there were a lot of debates between the sides about who said what when. Who did the president talk to? What was the quality of that conversation? Was, in fact, there a screaming match between Kevin McCarthy and the president about whether or not he should do something to call off the riot? Those things are all extremely relevant, and they'd be relevant to prosecutors as well. So I think there has to be a commission. I think there also should be an independent counsel. That's something that President Biden could appoint, or Merrick Garland, if and when he's confirmed, could appoint. And that would be far preferable to having the Justice Department go at this on their own, because of the appearance of partisanship and the degree to which it would drag down the Justice Department from other business.
It does seem as if Congress is going to work to establish an independent commission to investigate the insurrection. There are also concerns that this could turn attention away from President Biden's legislative agenda, or even deepen the political divide. Are those concerns valid, Julian Zelizer?
Look, I think our political system is capable of handling many issues at the same time. I mean, people can follow an investigation into something terrible that happened at our Capitol, and that leaves tons of space for the existing sitting administration to move forward with a vaccine and a stimulus program. In fact, that's what's happened over the last week plus. There were concerns about that, but from what I can see, the Biden administration is moving forward with the plan and moving forward aggressively. So I think the notion we're just a one-issue country isn't actually true. And I think we can, in fact, handle more than one issue. And in fact, it might be good for Biden to show that he is supporting some measures of accountability for former President Trump. It will only strengthen his hand as he moves forward with the stimulus.
We've got an email from Greg. Regardless of how good a case was put on by the House members, they were never going to get 67 votes until the GOP rectifies this split between Trump followers and Lincoln Project-type Republicans. It's hard to see how they'll win any national elections. And this rift seems like it will go on for a while. Claire, what do you think about this?
I think that's absolutely right. And I think that the Trumpism has come to define the party, but people are leaving the party in droves. And just since January 6th, there's been a mass exodus from the Republican Party. So I think we're sort of watching the self-destruction of the Republican Party. And Mitch McConnell has a problem. He knows it, and that's why he came out with this strange split, tearing into Donald Trump, saying that he provoked the violence, but at the same time hanging his hat on this fig leaf of an excuse having to do with the constitutionality of convicting a past president on an impeachment trial, which was a decision that the Senate had already voted on. It was already in the past. It was really a very poor excuse for deciding the way he did. But his split represents the split in the Republican Party. And he's got a very, very serious problem on his hands. How can he unite his party? I don't think he can at this point.
I'd like to get back to inflammatory rhetoric for a moment. Julian Zelizer, it's not new, of course, to this country's politics. Decades ago, we had presidential candidate George Wallace, infamous for his rhetoric, segregation today, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever. Historically, how have we as Americans responded to such speech, and how have we managed to bring the temperature down in the past?
Well, we don't always respond to that kind of speech very well. I mean, Wallace inflamed racial divisions through that kind of speech, both as a presidential candidate, but also as governor. And there were high costs to having politicians who did that. He literally helped to fuel white extremism and supremacy politics in the South, as did many other governors from the region. So I think that's evidence of why this can be very dangerous rather than why we have had it before. In terms of calming the temperature, it will be hard. We are a deeply polarized country. I believe we have a Republican Party that has become quite radicalized, and I don't think they're going to really change anytime soon. So this is the temperature in which governing will happen. That said, the former president took this to a whole new level, and I do think it's significant to have a successor who doesn't speak that way. I mean, it went from 100 to 0 under President Biden so far, and so that helps. But I do think we should look at January 6th. We should look at the last for years as an indication of where we are right now, rather than a moment that we've just passed through.
Claire, let's try to draw the line in the sand between inflammatory speech that is protected by the Constitution and unprotected speech. As you said earlier in the hour, you know, you can't falsely shout fire in a crowded theater.
Right, exactly. And so it all depends on what the president knew and what his intent was going into January 6th and in the run-up to January 6th. So, for example, look at the federal crime of solicitation to insurrection. That would probably be the crime that would be closest to the impeachment charge of inciting an insurrection. So this is actually a federal crime, rebellion or insurrection, 18 U.S.C. 2383, for those law buffs out there who want to look it up. That could be formulated as a conspiracy crime. Now, you don't get to claim First Amendment protection when you are knowingly inciting someone else to engage in a rebellion or an insurrection, or the crime of seditious conspiracy. I mean, every time you have more than one actor, people acting together, where you have one person encouraging the other, and that's sort of standard solicitation or accomplice liability, you have the use of words. And the criminal law just does not countenance that those words could be protected under the First Amendment when they are inspiring or inciting a crime. But what's critical here is the causal link between what Donald Trump did, what he knew, and what the rioters did on that day. And one would have to look at his state of mind, and that's where witnesses would have been critical.
Elaine, one of our listeners, Elaine, checks in with this comment pertaining to the witness kerfuffle. Something not mentioned is that many of the senators sitting as jurors were direct witnesses. They were in the fog of war, then informed by later reportage. Julian, what do you take from this?
Well, if I follow the question, yes, obviously there were a number of senators who were either explicitly involved in the last phase of the Stop the Steal, quote unquote, movement, including Senators Hawley and Cruz, who were very vocal on the day of and talking about challenging the certification of the votes. And there were many other Republicans who before that had either openly or passively tolerated what the president has been doing since November in going after the election and making allegations of voter fraud. So it was an unusual situation where, the jurors were implicated in the crime. And if you wanted witnesses, some of them might have been very important to hear from as well. But look, it's an impeachment process. It's not a trial. And so all these peculiar elements of it are not easily resolved.
We've got a question for Bruce, who asks, reports indicate that Senators Cruz, Lee, and Graham met with Donald Trump's defense team over the weekend. As jurors, doesn't this taint the independent process? And why was this meeting allowed to happen? Does Bruce have a point here, Claire Finkelstein?
Yes, he does. And impeachment is a very odd animal because you have the same group of individuals who were, as Julian pointed out, witnesses to what happened. They're also the jurors. They're also the judges because they're making up the rules as they go along, in effect. And in some cases, they may have been co-conspirators. They may have been involved in the planning of this. And then you have members of the Senate, like Cruz, going over to consult with the defense team. One of the interesting things that I saw was that the request to have a witness by House managers really threw Democratic leadership off guard. They were not expecting this. So Chuck Schumer was, I think suddenly surprised and reporting has it that up until the last moment, they did not know if House managers were going to request witnesses. Mm-hmm. That's because they were being careful not to consult one another. Now, in the case of Cruz consulting with the defense team, there's no rule against it. just as there are no rules on many things in impeachment, against a very, very odd vehicle from the standpoint of law. It's not a legal proceeding, but it does have a problematic look, and it does suggest just what the degree of coordination here has been between Senate and House Republicans and Donald Trump and his legal team.
Julian, at the end of the day, what impact did the horrific video footage of the insurrection seem to have on senators and on the vote? Two different questions, I think.
I do think it impacted the senators. I'd add to the list that the senators were also the victims, in addition to everything else, of this attack. And I think not only seeing it again, but seeing just how extreme many of the people there were in terms of what they intended to do, the violence they were looking to inflict on the vice president, on Speaker Pelosi. I do think it shook them, and I can't tell you how it affected some of the Republican Party that was most aligned with the president in the last month, but it shook them, and I suspect it was part of the 57 vote as opposed to a narrower vote. But for the public, I think it was significant. Even though he was acquitted, the record was pretty stunning because of that video footage of what we're talking about. This wasn't just a protest of a few people who were causing some chaos. This was a violent attack on Congress. And when you see the video and when you see the nuances of the video, there's no subtlety about what was going on. And when this comes up again, I think the video will be part of our public consciousness and how we think of what do we mean when we say there was an insurrection on January 6th?
Julian Zelizer is professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Claire Finkelstein is also with us through the end of the hour, professor of law and philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania. We're discussing the acquittal of former President Trump in his second impeachment trial. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in today for Marty Moskowain, and we will be right back. Stay with us. This is
supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Radio Times, I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowain today. We are discussing the second impeachment trial of a former President Trump and his acquittal and its implications, politics in the future. Our guests this hour, Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He is also the author of a new book, Burning Down the House, Newt Gingrich, The Fall of a Speaker and the Rise of the New Republican Party. Also with us, Claire Finkelstein, professor of law and philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania and director of Penn's Center for Ethics and the Rule of Law. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can give us a call at 888-477-9499. Tweet us at WHYY Radio Times or send an email to radiotimes@whyy.org. We have a comment from Rick who says, if we really want to heal, we need to remove people like Nancy Pelosi, who jumped into this trial with both feet. She doesn't realize the damage that this is doing to the country. Many Republicans, many who are on the side of former President Trump, say, Democrats were just eager once again to try to get him out of the political picture. How do we go about healing the divide? Claire Finkelstein, what do you think?
My own view is that accountability is absolutely essential to that process of healing. Look, coming out of the Bush administration, Obama made the decision on the torture memos and the torture program to look forward, not back, as he put it. And I think that was a terrible decision. Of course, I understand why he did it. The idea for any administration to try to hold the last administration responsible for crimes or engage in investigations of the former administration is a very uncomfortable place for an administration to be. And so I well understand that there may be reluctance to do that. But if you don't have a full airing of the facts, if you don't have full accountability, if you don't have some liability for those who broke the law, you may as well just kiss your republic goodbye, because you start to erode the principles that will protect us the next time around. The next time around, it may not be a coup of several hours, and there could have been much more bloodshed. That's one of the things that was clear from the video footage that was played. Those are our senators, our representatives were in incredible danger. So was the vice president. We could have had the murder of the vice president of the United States and the Speaker of the House. So we can't wait and just say, you know, we have too many other things to do and we need to heal. The best way to heal is to have full and clear accountability and responsibility where it's due.
Julian, as the insurrection was happening January 6th, former President Trump, or at the time, President Trump was condemning Vice President Mike Pence for not interfering in the tallying of the Electoral College votes. And of course, then many in the mob denounced Pence as a traitor, calling for his hanging. Is this something that could hurt Mr. Trump moving forward politically, especially with evangelical Christians?
Well, it could hurt. I mean, there's been reports, which Claire talked about the diminishing number of Republicans who are registering to be part of the party. And for that kind of trend, I imagine this could hurt. I mean, you're talking about one of the most solid Republicans in the country, Pence. And sure, maybe with evangelical voters, this hurts. But to contradict myself, and I'm happy to do that, I don't know. Partisanship is a powerful thing, and it has a powerful hold in the Republican Party right now. I would argue more so than with Democrats. And as we saw during the last 4 years, nothing has really shaken the hold of the GOP on that evangelical constituency. So it might be that even with a story as dramatic as this, even with the potential victim being one of the heads of the evangelical Republican coalition, it doesn't shake that coalition as much as you think. And I don't know which way it's going to go, to be honest.
You know, Mary, can I add something?
Sure.
Can I add something quickly here? The other thing is that Donald Trump made war on law enforcement. And that's a bridge too far for many, many people, because this is supposed to be the law and order party. But when you see Capitol Police getting murdered, when you see a mob chasing after law enforcement, when you see the slogans and the insults that rioters were chanting against law enforcement, it is very, very hard for Republicans to take the position after that, if they support a president who instigated that, yes, we are the law enforcement party and the law and order party.
Julian, to you first on this question, for better or for worse, you know, Donald Trump is a charismatic figure. Have we seen a leader like this to compare in American history?
Well, we've seen lots of charismatic leaders, but in terms of a politician who plays to backlash politics the way he does, we've mentioned that person already. It was George Wallace. And Wallace was very good at this, and he understood the kind of underside of American politics. And rather than running away from it, he took a deep dive into it. He was never as successful as President Trump. And I'd also add, Joe McCarthy was very astute in a bad way at understanding the flaws of the media and how to exploit them. And those are two figures that I think helped to provide some of the foundation. And finally, the person I wrote about, Newt Gingrich, who from Congress used that kind of charisma and that appeal to the deepest divisions in the American electorate to rise to power, to change the Republican Party. And you take those three people and you could see the mix that ended up being President Trump.
Never hurts to take a look in the mirror. What lessons do the mainstream media take from the Trump years? The media have been accused of giving him too much oxygen, particularly when he was first campaigning ahead of 2016, Julian.
Yeah, I think the media is still trying to figure out some of the lessons, but exposure can have costs. And I think producers, editors, writers have to be thoughtful about how they cover a politician or a political movement like this. They have to be more willing to be explicit about what's true and what's not true. They have to be more judicious in terms of deciding what should get airtime and what kinds of events are simply an effort by a politician to promote themselves. And finally, they have to have some sense of, in a divided, polarized world, not everything's the same. And they have to be willing to say that. When this is an insurrection we're talking about, it's not simply a deeply divided system where people don't agree. This is a violent attack. And reporters need a way to talk about that in a language that makes it clear to readers and viewers and listeners exactly what we're looking at this moment.
Comments are coming in. We've got an email from Naomi who asks, if you make the argument that the insurrection was months in the making due to denials of the legitimacy of the election, doesn't that make McConnell, Hawley, Cruz, etc., co-conspirators, or at least a critical part of the insurrection? Claire?
I think the comment has a lot of merit to it. And let's not forget that there is a Senate ethics probe into two senators, Hawley and Cruz. The very uncomfortable fact about that Senate ethics probe is that Senator Lankford actually sits on the Senate Ethics Committee, and arguably he was also one of the co-conspirators, and there were members of the House. So this is a very, very difficult situation in which we had so many politicians actually involved in the months-long disinformation campaign around who had won the election and really revving up the far right-wing base and contributing to what you can absolutely think of as a kind of radicalization of the population. As I heard Jim Comey on air saying, it's really not entirely unlike what has happened, in the Middle East with ISIS, and a radicalization from a charismatic leader who convinces people of things that are not true and revs them up into a frenzy. A lot of politicians need to take responsibility for that, and a lot of lawyers need to take responsibility for what happened because they contributed to the general disinformation as well.
Question from Matthew. What happened to the investigation that Congresswoman Mikie Sherrill announced into whether Republicans had hosted an unusual number of outsiders touring the Capitol just prior to the insurrection? Julian Zelizer, I don't know if you have any of this information at your fingertips, but guessing that if there is a congressional inquiry, some of this might come out.
Yeah, I don't know where her investigation is right now, if it's continuing or if it's going to be formalized through the committee structure, but I think it's very important. And it gets to this question of what happened in the month before, or even longer, frankly, when many Republicans were involved in this effort to really overturn the election. And at the most basic level, we want to know, were tours being given consciously to organizations and individuals who are going to be part of this? Was there planning? This is a compliment to the commission Pelosi is putting together, or it will be handled by the commission. But Congresswoman Sherrill raised a central question that I don't think should fall off the radar just because we are now moving into, you know, mid-February of politics.
And Mary sends this email. Is there any way that ordinary citizens could bring a criminal charge against Mr. Trump for any of his many infringements that could keep him from running again? Claire Finkelstein?
Well, I definitely think that there can be civil suits arising out of the events of January 6th, and I expect we may well see some civil suits. So the families of those who died could well bring civil actions. And then again, there are the various possibilities of criminal investigations, criminal probes that may occur. And I do think that the question of tours of the Capitol building and whether or not there were members of Congress could potentially expose them to liability, and whether or not there was more active involvement in planning these events. There was reporting about the Republican Attorney General's Association and whether or not they were actively involved in planning the events of the day. So a wide-ranging commission would look into all of these issues, and while the commission itself wouldn't be part of any criminal or civil investigation, it would certainly aid investigators in the work that they would be doing on the criminal side and potentially the civil cases as well.
Julian, this is now 3 presidential impeachments in the past quarter century, and some worry this might become a kind of the new normal. Do you think those fears are warranted?
Sure. I think it's fair in an age of polarization to worry about how processes can be both normalized and weaponized. And I don't think that's an insignificant fear, but I think this was a totally warranted impeachment. That doesn't mean you don't use a process. And I think when it's necessary, even if those fears exist, Congress has an obligation, frankly, certainly the House did, to move forward with this and to see where things fell on the Senate. Look, remember, Bill Clinton, President Clinton was impeached. That was certainly toxic. But then we went for a period without this really being part of the conversation. And I also think right now we can survive the fact that it's been used and employed twice. I think our political system can also withstand that much more so than it can withstand the abuse of presidential power and violence triggered from the top.
Comment from Steve. I'm a career combat vet, and one of the things that's hurting the GOP is not being able to recognize the pathology of Trump. All of his comments would disqualify him from service, but he was allowed to run the country. The insurrection was a natural outcome. Claire Finkelstein?
Well, I think that's exactly right. There were many, many points at which Mitch McConnell could have put up a fight against former President Trump and other members of the GOP. It was really sort of time and time again a horrible spectacle of having GOP elected officials just sort of roll over on this. And they bear an enormous share of responsibility. There could have been, and it was the natural outcome, I think, of someone who told us that he was not going to accept the results of the election unless the election went in his favor. So we knew that this was coming. We didn't plan well for it. And in effect, you know, the 4 years leading up to this moment really prepared us to expect it. And we didn't do all that we could to stop it.
And finally, an email from Bob. Why is there all of this talk about ethics probes, commissions, investigations, etc.? Who really cares if there's no jail time? Common folks in this country think it's all political speak unless someone actually pays the price in jail time. Does it really matter? And again, Julian, got about 30 seconds here. Does this speak to the deep political divide in this country about how we move on?
It does, but it matters. This was very, very bad. It was a terrible moment in our democracy. And unless we are committed to holding people accountable, we never heal. And even if the mass of the electorate isn't focused on this, issues like the gross abuse of presidential power are central for us to grapple with and to fix before it's too late.
All right, Julian Zelizer, great to have you with us. Thanks so much.
You. Thanks for having us.
Julian is professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, also the author of a new book, Burning Down the House, Newt Gingrich, The Fall of a Speaker and the Rise of the New Republican Party. And Claire Finkelstein, a pleasure as well.
Thank you for having me, Mary.
Claire Finkelstein is professor of law and philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania and director of Penn's Center for Ethics and the Rule of Law. And don't forget, our rebroadcast airs at 11 this evening. You can also find us online at whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producers are Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks for joining us.